The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 29th of March 2023 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Allianz Partners. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's programme, Hungary continues lying down in front of Sweden's progress towards NATO. Will AUKUS shortly have to rebrand as AUKUS-ns or AUNZ-suck? And why is it so hard to build 900 new apartments in Berlin? That's all coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. It is now nearly a year since Sweden and Finland submitted a joint application to join NATO in the wake of Russia's assault upon Ukraine. It seemed at the time that this would be a pretty straightforward process. However, nearly a year later, it isn't done yet. One remaining hurdle has been surmounted, with Hungary's parliament voting to ratify Finland's bid. However, Hungary, along with Turkey, is continuing to be difficult about Sweden. I'm joined with more by Elizabeth Brohr, Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Elizabeth, Hungary's government is referring vaguely to grievances with Sweden. What do they mean?
Yes, grievances can include a lot of things, but in this case, it's that the Hungarians feel that the Swedish government has been lecturing them over the years, especially in recent years. And that is indeed the case. Sweden has been one of the governments that have told the government of President Orban to essentially become more liberal democratic and give up his authoritarian ways. And you can say they are right to make that. They've been right to make that point. But when the problem in international diplomacy is you may need a country at one point, and then that country won't appreciate you having lectured them. And that's where things stand now. We should also remember that Sweden has a new government as of last autumn. So these complaints refer also to the previous government, which was indeed very active in complaining about Hungary.
Is it clear what Orban actually wants, or is he just grandstanding? It would not be the first time.
It would not be the first time that he's grandstanding. And we should remember he has grievances about many fellow EU countries, because many fellow EU countries have been criticizing his government, which has indeed been turning more authoritarian over the years, as your listeners know. And it's not clear what he wants from Sweden. I think he just wants to air his grievances and maybe receive an apology. But of course, it's difficult for a government to apologize for making observations that government feels is correct. And it's also difficult for a government to apologize on behalf of its predecessors. So it's a really tricky situation. But the problem, I think the fundamental problem, is that Sweden never expected to need anything from countries like Hungary and Turkey. And now all of a sudden needs something, and something very specific and very important.
As you correctly point out, Sweden does have a new government who has had this diplomatic challenge dropped in their lap. How are they responding so far?
They are striking a fine balance, I think, between defending Sweden and Sweden's right to, for example, receive received Kurdish, I was about to say Hungarian, received Kurdish asylum seekers. And that is within a country's rights. But it's also trying to accommodate, especially Turkey, as much as possible. And that's something that I think the previous government would have been loath to do because they didn't particularly like Turkey at all. But of course, you can't bend over backwards too much because you do have to defend your country's rights to take its own decisions. So it is a very difficult situation for this government because it's having to deal with problems created by the previous government, which had been in power for a long time in various iterations. But so far, so good. But unfortunately, the situation doesn't just depend on the Swedish government. It really depends mostly on the Hungarians and the Turks, or should we say President Erdogan.
I mean, polls suggest that the idea of NATO membership remains very popular among Swedes. Is there any amount of impatience discernible among the Swedish public, or do they generally appreciate that there's a limited amount Sweden's government can do about this?
Yes, to both. I think many Swedes have by now made up their minds that NATO membership would be a good thing and a positive thing, and that it would be paradoxical to retract your application because it's not going very well within a short period of time. But then again, I think that the risk is that paradoxically, because the US and the UK in particular have given security guarantees to Sweden and Finland for the period of time between their application and their accession, because the security guarantees exist, I think the longer this drags on, the more Swedes will say, well, if we have those security guarantees anyway, why do we have to wait for NATO membership? And that is indeed a case you can make. If the Americans will protect you, even if you're not a member of NATO, why should you wait for NATO membership and have to appease Erdogan and the Hungarians? But that said, the support for now remains strong in favour of getting into NATO.
Just finally then, the line from Swedish officials, including the foreign minister speaking on Monocle 24, is that they're still pretty confident that this will get done at least before the next NATO summit in Vilnius in a few months. Does that still seem a likely trajectory?
Well, he would say that, wouldn't he? He would be a terrible foreign minister if he expressed doubt that it would happen. But the time is not very long until the Vilnius summit, which is coming up this summer. And a lot of things have to happen. Specifically, two things have to happen: the ratification by Hungary and Turkey that seem to have to need to be preceded by conciliatory talks or concessions by Sweden, and so there is not very much time left, and that is a challenge. It seemed so obvious last May when Sweden and Finland submitted applications that this would be done long before the Vilnius summit, and it would be the easiest accession ever. And for Finland, it has turned out to be relatively easy. For Sweden, less so. And now it's really down to the wire with just about 3 months to go.
Elizabeth Brauer, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing. Here is Monocle's Carlotta Ribello with the day's other headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. The Chinese government has threatened retaliation if Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen meets the U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy this week. Tsai left Taiwan today for a 10-day trip to visit Central American allies Belize and Guatemala, and the trip includes two stopovers in New York and Los Angeles. Beijing urged U.S. not to let her transit through the country, saying it would be a provocation. The International Olympic Committee has recommended that Russian and Belarusian athletes be allowed to compete under a neutral flag, but has yet to make a decision on the upcoming Paris 2024 Games. It added that athletes who actively support the war in Ukraine or who are contracted to the military should not be allowed to compete. And more than 2,000 women are taking the Swiss government to court, claiming its policy on climate change is violating their right to life and health. This is the first time the European Court of Human Rights will hear a case on the impact of climate change on human rights. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Carlotta. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. Now, AUKUS, the trilateral security pact linking Australia, the United Kingdom and the United States, may shortly have to figure out how to incorporate an N and a Z into its acronym. New Zealand has confirmed that it is in talks to join the alliance up to a point. Since the 1980s, New Zealand has been a determinedly nuclear-free zone, which would obviously forestall New Zealand from participating in the aspects of AUKUS pertaining to the operation of nuclear-powered submarines. Well, I'm joined with more on this by Lizette Raymer, Europe correspondent with News Hub. Lizette, what has New Zealand's government said about this? What is their interest in AUKUS?
Yeah, I think this has almost caught people a little bit off guard, because for a long time there's been discussion of AUKUS and New Zealand has been relatively quiet on it. But following a meeting with Washington, there is now some discussion about New Zealand potentially joining the second tranche of it. So obviously we are staunchly nuclear free. There is no interest in joining up in regards to the submarines, but there is a second aspect to the deal that would allow us to share technology, share intelligence information, and make sure that we're kept up to date and progressive with our technology, and then join that pact on that front. So that is the one area which they are considering joining. It definitely isn't something they've said they will do. They're simply saying they've been offered a role in it if there was room for New Zealand to join it without compromising any of our staunch beliefs on the nuclear front. And our government is simply saying we'll look into it. However, that has already been enough to spark a fierce debate.
I will come back to that debate, but is there an aspect here, do you think, of New Zealand trying to reverse into or somehow reanimate its participation in ANZUS, which was a slightly less formal arrangement between Australia, New Zealand and the United States, which still kind of exists, but New Zealand's participation is somewhat in abeyance?
Yeah, I think New Zealand at the moment is just in this very tricky, awkward situation where it is trying to keep China happy, but also stay aligned with our only military alliance, which is Australia, and try and continue to make sure that we're supporting Australia and we're on the right side of any potential conflict and all of the concern that is happening down in our area of the world, which quite frankly we haven't really had to deal with to this degree before. So I think it's just that ongoing struggle to align ourselves with Australia and make sure we're supporting them, but also not upset China too much. And I think New Zealand's running into a bit of trouble with that at the moment.
Well, I mean, it is a tricky balance, as Australia itself has discovered in recent years. But you suggested that this could be domestically controversial. What are the parameters of that row going to be?
I think New Zealand is only just starting. I think this has been a real turning point of people probably not realising how serious this is. And now that Andrew Little, one of our ministers, has expressed interest in, our defence minister has expressed interest in joining AUKUS, people are saying, hang on, is this the right decision for us, or are we going to be provoking? Is it provocation to be joining an alliance like this when, you know, we can essentially sit here and be a neutral country? And that's where the debate now is fired up. You know, both of our former prime ministers, Jim Bolger and Helen Clark, have come out sternly saying we should not have anything to do with this deal because we're essentially saying to China, we're not on your side, you are the enemy. Whereas others are saying, our you know, one of our veterans of Parliament, Winston Peters, who was a troublemaker at the best of times, but he has come out and said the best thing we can do is protect ourselves. We're just asking for trouble if we don't align ourselves with some sort of protection. So it's that whole, the argument's going to come down to do we want to prepare for a potential attack, or do we want to be incredibly neutral and so that we're not poking the beast and that we can be safe if anything did escalate. But we've seen, you know, our foreign minister has just been in Beijing for the first time in 4 years. So we haven't been there and had conversations with Chinese officials in so long, but this is obviously New Zealand desperately trying to walk that tightrope of we're still going to have these good relationships with with China, who are a huge export-import partner for us. And we're still going to try and be friends with Australia and the US. So it is a very fine line that I think soon, very soon, we're going to have to draw a line under and pick a side.
Because it is fair to say, isn't it, that the Helen Clarkist tendency has rather prevailed in New Zealand over recent years. There's been a fairly dramatic scaling back of the New Zealand Defence Forces. Obviously, there were those international stories that everybody had a bit of a chuckle at recently about the Royal New Zealand Navy being unable to find enough sailors to put on its ships. Is that starting to change?
I think it is a little bit. New Zealand hasn't really seen, and definitely the public, you know, the voters haven't seen a whole heap of incentive in investing in our military and prioritising our defence force. And we've even seen, you know, a huge drop off, as you say, in numbers of people even signing up for any of our defence forces. And I think now, obviously, with the war in Ukraine, and the situation that is escalating or feeling like it's escalating with China and in our part of the world, I think the general population is starting to think, hang on, are we actually prepared or at all ready for if things did, you know, turn nasty in our part of the world or escalate to a point where we actually did need to have some defences as a deterrence? Because at the moment, we're so staunchly not prioritising that we just kind of appear like a sitting duck. And I think Joe Bloggs in Hamilton or Auckland is starting to think, hey, maybe our government should be prioritising this, should be investing in this. So I think that absolutely the tide is turning in that regard, but there are still those old school, those who are just really going to protect that stance for as long as possible. And Helen Clark's certainly leading that charge.
Just finally and quickly, you have partially answered this, but is the nuclear-free thing an absolutely untouchable, sacrosanct cornerstone of Kiwi thinking at this point? Because this is a policy that it is introduced a long time ago now, at a point at which it was largely directed at nuclear testing by France.
No, it is untouchable. Honestly, just on a level of, if you walk down the street and ask people what is New Zealand most proud of, people would say we are nuclear free. That was New Zealand's big moment in history. There's a lot of sentimental pride that comes with that decision of leading the world at that time. And people are very proud to continue that legacy. And I don't think, even though, as you say, things maybe have changed in terms of the context, people do not want to sacrifice that. People still talk about it often. It is brought up all the time that we are nuclear free and we are proud of it. And I don't think anyone in Parliament or in the public would think that that is something we would be comfortable changing.
Lizette Raymer, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
You asked, we delivered. Welcome to The Concierge, a travel show from Monocle, brought to you in association with Allianz Partners. This week, we explore the delights of Helsinki's most fascinating food and drink destinations.
I really love this place. You can come here any time of the evening and eat something small, eat a long dinner, have an expensive bottle of great wine, or just one glass of something simple.
And travel to St Moritz for ski season without the skis.
The ice is melting, but I am told that it's at a safe 45 centimetres. So even though I'm standing in a puddle, I think everyone is going to be okay.
The Concierge, in association with Allianz Partners. Listen via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your audio.
You are back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. Now, in common with many booming cities, Berlin is struggling to find accommodation for everyone who wishes to live there, and Berliners who do live there are facing rocketing rents for such homes as there are. Unlike most similarly vexed conurbations, however, Berlin has what has long seemed an obvious solution, the vast abandoned space of Tempelhof Airport, from which nothing has taken off for 15 years. Tempelhof has since been left to the weeds and the ghosts through a combination of indolence and sentiment, but that now seems about to change. I'm joined with more on this by Monocle contributor Jessica Bridger. Jessica, what is the latest? There are at least and at last going to be some new homes built.
Yes, it looks like there is some movement as the government has changed. And in the past year, the Berlin Senate Commission on Housing was established, and that is trying to make the approval of up to 20,000 apartments to be built each year possible.
I mean, this is a huge site at Tempelhof. Why has it taken so long to get around to it?
Because it's so contentious, because the airport stopped operating in 2008. And ever since then, it's become a beloved public space. So it's kind of this wild, anything goes, massive, you know, 300 hectare wilderness of urban proportion. And so people are reluctant to have housing built. But now it seems like a majority of Berliners are open to that, because the housing crisis there is really stark. There's been about a million apartments, I've seen numbers, that haven't been built in the last decade. And even with just population growth, like no change within the city, they need to build 320,000 new units by 2030.
I mean, when you say that the housing crisis is stark, how bad has it got and how quickly? Because you don't need that long a memory to recall a time when people were flocking to Berlin agog at the plentiful spaces and relatively reasonable rent.
Yeah, and that's when I moved there in 2008, it was near the end of that. So it very quickly became really difficult to find units, and the lines to get any apartment that was above market rate were quite long. You were competing against 50 people. Now, where that, you know, stark housing situation is most painful is where you need subsidized rent or, you know, below market rate rents. And that has become really urgent and dire, to the extent where expropriation of large landowners and large apartment kind of conglomerates is now being discussed. So it's something that very quickly, within about, you know, a decade, changed completely. As the city, you know, as development in the city sped up and it became more appealing, but then as people come in from outside and either invest or just come to live, it pushes people who have a more, you know, constrained housing ability out of the center and then out of the city entirely.
You said the Tempelhof space had become beloved, and not unreasonably. It is an extraordinary thing for any city to have this sort of an enormous weed-covered ruin. Quite picturesque, though, in many respects. That being the case, are these new developments going to be at all controversial? Will there be a Save Tempelhof tendency?
I think that we're going to see that continue. That's not going to change. But just yesterday, there was news that would indicate that maybe there's going to be movement on Tempelhof, which is in the Tempelhof area, because that's a city quarter of Berlin named after the airport. The Marienhofe was just approved. And that's a small site. It's only 10 hectares and it's 900 units. But it's a super interesting mix of social needs and, you know, providing housing, but it's also mixed use with commercial. And it's towards something Berlin wants to do, which is to make a city of short distances. So we all know the 15-minute city and these concepts to make things walkable. And Berlin already is that anyway. And in this area with the Tempelhofer Feld and these large green open spaces, this could be an amazing place to do high density development in a way that's sensitive to the social and, you know, commercial needs of the area, and really strengthen Berlin's character. So there is movement that things might get better and that things might then on Tempelhofer Feld become more likely to be developed, but to keep that wild urban character, right?
Jessica Bredger, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. This This is The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. And finally, on today's show, Transport for London have announced what they are optimistically declaring a fast bus network to link London's outer suburbs. The Superloop, as the name suggests, is mapped as a circle, its north, south, east and west being respectively approximately Arnos Grove, Croydon, Docklands and Heathrow. This is potentially exciting news for people who wish to avoid travelling via central London and or who simply enjoy being confined on a largely stationary vehicle, involuntarily inhaling vape smoke and listening to other people's FaceTime calls. I'm joined with more on this by Monocle's editor-in-chief, Andrew Tuck. Andrew, do we think this justifies the branding Super, as in Superloop?
Well, it's stealing, trying to steal some thunder from the world of the Hyperloop and this notion of like travelling at the speed of light almost to get from one place to another. I don't think, as you've hinted, that that is quite the case. It's an attempt to make a circular bus route around London. Now, why should this be interesting to people who are not in London, let alone in cities around the world that have better public transport? Because it taps into a bigger debate. Here in London, we have an ultra-low emission zone, which is going to expand in August, bringing in potentially another 700,000 drivers who have to pay £12.50 if they wanted to drive into the city centre. The numbers are, of course, much disputed depending where you sit on the side of the debate. And because there is quite a lot of anger, including five boroughs who say they will not bring this in and are going to court to try and stop it, there needs to be some kind of soothing of people in the outer boroughs to say, look, we're thinking about your needs. I know we're going to make you leave the car on the drive, but we've got a bus for you now. And that isn't to mock this. You know, it is good that we put in public transport, but you have to see it as part of a bigger picture. It's as a salve for what is becoming a really ugly discussion in many parts of London.
Well, indeed so. But is this not also a bit of a swizz given how many buses and services have been cut in recent years? The London bus fleet has been reduced by 11% since 2016.
And also there's a little bit of rebranding here. There's 10 bus routes, some of which won't launch until 2025 or beyond. And four of them are existing bus routes, but they're going to have new branding on the buses that go on those routes. So it's not all brand new. And as you say, most of it is to connect the outer boroughs. And I think that maybe there is some connectivity needed there. For example, the gentleman who runs Heathrow Airport said, actually, we have a lot of workers who have to come here every day from parts of around places around London. You know, they're making the meals that go on your planes. They're cleaning the aircraft. Those people are not high paid staff. They don't maybe have a car, and they have to trundle to work often at poor times. So maybe those people will be keen. But I see one of the routes is from central London. In fact, near where I live, right down to Croydon. And in fact, I can't quite see why it would work, because there are so many train services now that are fast to Croydon that I don't think that it would assuage many people to kind of, you know, to change the way that they travel. So it is good. And we have to remember that if we are going to get people out of their cars and to use more public transport, there needs to be more of it. As you say, not good on the buses, and also not good because people have come to see public transport in London in the last year as something that's very unreliable, whether you come by train or on the underground, because there have been so many strikes, so many broken services, so many issues that I think people there is a little bit of a tension point that is no one's fault. It just things are not that good out there.
I mean, it has always been the case about London's public transport that it is fantastic when it works. But as you correctly suggest, quite a lot of the time recently, it hasn't. But do you think there are things that can be done? And are there? You mentioned that other cities will be looking at how this works to absorb lessons for them. But are there places that London could learn lessons from in terms of just making buses more pleasant things to be on? Because as I cunningly foreshadowed in my introduction, they're often quite obnoxious, which is largely due to the behaviour of other passengers.
Well, I suppose you get rid of Londoners. I don't know what you can do about that part. I think that you're right that there is a kind of often an atmosphere on buses which isn't always the best. But there's also just a strange thing that, you know, London buses are built to be anti-graffiti, you know, anti-vandal. So the lighting is bright. The seating is like is made almost bomb-proof. And the truth is, you know, they're not enticing environments. But when I was in Brussels recently, they've actually said, look, why don't we put leather seats actually in some of the buses, and why don't we try toning down the lighting? And they have become more pleasant places to travel in. So I think that there's a payoff. I think that it's going to be difficult to make a bus as pleasant as having your own private car, but it has to happen. So it's going to be a jostle. But in if you read the press at the moment, when you look at some of the headlines, you know, the Daily Mail this week had a headline, I believe yesterday, saying, you know, the fight back against the 15-minute city, which we know is going on, and they had pictures of people putting boxes over the cameras for the ultra low emission zones. That if you read any of the papers on the right in this country, they've been talking about this project, this Superloop project, as, you know, the war on drivers takes its next step. So the battle lines are drawn, but we know that something needs to happen in the middle, and that's the consensus, but it's difficult to find.
Andrew Tuck, thank you for joining us. And that is all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello. Our researcher was Monica Lillis, and our studio manager was Nora Huell. The Briefing returns tomorrow at the same time, midday London. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.